Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. I'm delighted to be here today with Lord Lee. He started his investing career at the age of 15, which was inspired by his father, and went on to have a career as a chartered accountant. In 1979, became a MP, which carried on until 1992. And then there was a break until he became a member of the House of Lords. He's been a retail investor evangelist, self-confessed, and is a patron of ShareSoc, and wins the award, I believe, for being the first ISA millionaire in 2003. Which came out of his PEP, which he started in 1987. The dividend yield from his ISA gives him annually today the total invested capital that he originally put into the ISA. So that shows you the power of compounding. He has written over 250 articles for the FT and has written two investing books, one, How to Make a Million Slowly, which I highly recommend. And he's just published Yummy Yogurt, A First Taste of Stock Market Investment, which, if you like, is a primer for teenagers to, within 35 pages, which takes an hour or two to read, to understand the theory of investing. And it's an enchanting book that's very common sense to read. It introduces lots of technical terms, but you're almost in oblivion that those technical terms have been introduced. So congratulations. What was the catalyst for writing this book, and what did you hope to achieve from it?
I've always been conscious that financial education, financial teaching in our schools has really almost been non-existent. It is improving a little bit now, but pretty well non-existent. And therefore, you've got so many young people who are entering the world of work and careers, you know, post university or similar, with no real knowledge of the world of investment. So, the book, the idea behind the book Yummy Yogurt, is to give particularly teenagers. A first taste of stock market investment. I call the book a primer because it's really very much about the basics of investment. So it's not only to encourage new people to think about the world of the stock market and investing, but also I'm very, very conscious of a whole range of young people who in time will inherit shares or share portfolios from their parents or grandfather or godfather and have absolutely no knowledge to be able to take their own decisions. Now, it may well be that those young people who inherit don't want to take the decisions themselves, and therefore they have an independent financial advisor or a wealth manager or a stockbroker who will take the decisions for them. But what I want them to do, the youngsters to do, is to have an awareness and a knowledge themselves, which will enable them to understand what's being recommended and from time to time perhaps to challenge what is being suggested. So this book, I think, and I'm really saying to young people, look, give me 2 or 3 hours of your time. And I think I will have taught you the basics of stock market investment.
Well, I thought it was amazing. It's just 35 pages long, and you sort of get straight stuck into price earnings ratios and complicated accounting terms. But it reads like a little book, sort of, that's very straightforward and very common sense, and it doesn't blind you with science. And by the end of it, you've learned quite a lot without realising that you've been learning it.
Well, obviously, I'm pleased that you say that. I took the view that if I produced a heavy tome on the stock market of 150 pages, and obviously I could write that sort of book, that I don't think young people would even open it. It would just be left on the shelf. And therefore, I deliberately went for something that was short, I think, easy to read with a basic story of a business that does develop and goes public, and also hopefully looks quite attractive and is also fairly tactile as well. I'm pleased so far with the reaction.
And when I read it, I felt that it could appeal to older investors who have never thought of stock market investing as well. What sort of qualities do you think a teenager or any adult needs to have as an investor?
Over the years, obviously, I've debated this with myself and honed my views. And I've boiled them down to really two. I think there are two things that you need to be a successful investor. Only two things, because it really is very simple. Common sense and patience. Common sense and patience. And of the two, patience is the most important. And patience is the thing that is most difficult to get across to people. Particularly so in this world of advancing technologies, where because it's so easy to look at one's holdings and see current movements in share prices, there is a temptation to take a profit if you see it. Whereas really, you've got to be, I think, to be a successful investor, to be in a state of mind where you understand that you're buying a small portion of a business, a slice of the cake. And over the years, you want that cake to actually grow and deliver capital growth and dividend growth as well. And in my view, the way to make money long term is actually to hold shares, as it were, in good companies and be patient.
So with patience comes... you can be patient if you know what your expectations are. So what expectations should people have in terms of returns they can expect in a year from their investments?
It's very difficult to say because obviously percentages do change dependent on overall economic circumstances and international events. And therefore, one of my key philosophies is to make sure that I invest in companies that actually are paying a dividend. And therefore, if companies are paying a dividend, and hopefully it's an increasing dividend, you are getting some return each year, almost irrespective of whether your overall share portfolio moves up or down. And I think the dividend yield, the dividend return, is so important because the payment of a dividend by a company reflects three things, really. It reflects the results of the company for the last 12 months, the view of the board as to what the company is likely to deliver over the next 12 months, and also, of course, it says we have enough cash to actually pay the dividend. And therefore, I've always been focused on companies that are paying a dividend. So, getting an annual return through dividend income is important. The capital return can vary. I wouldn't like to say what figure one is looking at each year, but obviously over the long term, one is looking for substantial appreciation. And I've had individual shares over the years that have gone up, 10, 15, 20 times. And that's where you do make real money on long-term holdings, provided you're patient.
But those would be the minority and not the normality.
Yes. Let's look at it another way. The key to successful investment also is to avoid losing money. And therefore, by going into the types of businesses that I've talked about in Yummy Yogurt, you can avoid some of the obvious riskier areas of investment. So I say, for example, in the book, don't invest in exploration stocks, don't invest in biotech stocks, don't invest in startups, and also don't invest in contracting businesses, because all those contracting businesses, they all hit bad contracts from time to time. Now, I'm not saying that people can't make money by investing in startups or biotech stocks or exploration stocks, but I'm saying that really they're best left to people who focus on those sectors and are experts in those sectors. For the average investor, I say steer well clear of those and concentrate on companies that are already established, that have been trading for some time, that are paying a dividend, that are not overborrowed, and businesses that you can understand as well.
But in terms of risk, do you think it goes with the territory of investing that you've got to accept that there will sometimes be profit warnings and there will sometimes be risk? I mean, in Yummy Yogurt, it's an ideal dream in that its open offer is at £3. It goes up 20% on the first day. And then 5 years later, it has an acquisition. It's acquired and you've made over four times your money because it's acquired at £13 when it was initially launched at £3. So, and in the meantime, you've got 50% dividends.
Sure.
So, of course, everyone's going to think, wow, investing's great.
Yes.
But the reality is slightly different.
Of course,
even
it is.
If you avoid the biotech and the mining,
sure,
and
sure. It is. I mean, all stock market investment, all investment in businesses carries with it a degree of risk. But I contend that by following certain rules and guidelines, you can actually avoid a lot of that risk. A lot of it is unnecessarily taken. Of course. In Yummy Yogurt, it is a success story. And I do make the point in the book that, one is unlikely to find another investment so easily like Yummy Yogurt. But on the other hand, I don't think it's difficult for a new investor over a period to find that they make more success, they have more successes than failures. But it's the, it's, I draw parallels sometimes between the stock market and golf. So your round of golf is going well until you get to the 17th hole, when bang, you hit the ball into the river or into the woods, and the whole round is ruined. So similarly with stock market portfolio, when you have a number of stocks, if you can avoid the disasters, the really bad shots, then overall, you will be successful.
Now, in the book, the children get their money from an inheritance from their grandfather, and they get £2,500 each, and they invest £600 in Yummy Yogurt. These are quite small figures. How much do you think you need as a sum to even start investing?
I think probably, top of the head, £500 to £1,000. And with that, one can buy one share or two shares and make a start. You put a toe into the stock market and you build up your capital through savings, maybe some growth in the shares that you buy, but also you're increasing your knowledge. I've built up my share portfolios, my ISA, over the years, and my knowledge, brick by brick. And we all make mistakes. I mean, I've made many mistakes in my investment life, and I'm sure I will make mistakes in the future. By careful analysis and by examining what you have done, why things have gone wrong, you can, as I said before, eliminate most of the risk. There will always be the disaster that strikes from left field, where there's an announcement all of a sudden that there's some irregularity in the accountancy aspect of a business, or they've calculated their stock wrongly, or something's gone wrong, or a major contract has been cancelled, or a major contract has gone wrong. Those things do come along from time to time, because you are investing in a business and there is an element of risk. But I come back to my point that you can eliminate a lot of that risk by being sensible and applying common sense.
And you don't think because of that risk you need slightly more than 500 or 1,000, because you've got very little scope to spread your risk then. And many people would say, oh, no, you need more than that.
Well, what I can say is that I think my first investment was when I was 15 or 16, was £45. Admittedly, that was worth a lot more then. But even so, £45, which I invested in from memory in a company called Aviation and Shipping, who owned one ship, And the ship went down, and my £45 went down with it. So it wasn't the greatest of starts to an investment career, but one learns. So when I look back through my old investment ledgers, I originally bought £100 worth of shares or £200 worth of shares. So you can start with relatively small amounts of money. Indeed, it's more sensible to start with small amounts of money. You're taking less of a risk, as it were, and hopefully building up over a period. And something like an ISA these days obviously encourages people to save and to reinvest those dividends as well.
So the readers of Yummy Yogurt are all poised. They've got their £1,000 and they want to start investing. Do you think the book alone will take them to a place where they can start investing, or do they then have to read your other book?
No. My hope is that by reading Yummy Yogurt, they will have enough knowledge to make a start. Now, I would hope through the book to have engendered some interest, sufficient interest for them to think this is a world that really looks quite interesting, could be quite attractive, and I can make some money as well. And then hopefully, having read the book, then maybe start to read some weekly investment publications.
Such as
The Investor's Chronicle, for example, and similar investment magazines. And then also to read, not all, but some of the City columns in the more serious papers, which perhaps up to now they've ignored, gradually build up their knowledge. Very recently, some friends of ours who I gave the Yummy to gave it to one of their sons who read it one afternoon. And the following day, the parents were amazed and amused to discover that on the kitchen table was a copy of the Financial Times, which had never appeared before. You know, their son had been sufficiently enthused and interested by the book to actually, you know, want to go on and develop his knowledge. So it's all part of, I think, the evangelistic approach, which I have, which is to try and encourage more people to save, more people to invest, more people to take their own decisions.
And when you investigate a share yourself, how long do you spend on one company on that investigation when you're trying to choose whether you're going to buy into it?
That's very difficult to say. I know now, having looked at so many companies, invested in so many over the years, the basic things that I'm looking for. I think the easiest way of answering your question is to say that normally what I will do will be to invest a small amount initially in a particular company. And then as I get to know it better, maybe I go to the AGM of that company and meet the management, maybe read up more about the company. I feel that much more confident. I then build up my holding. In some cases, I've invested in and bought shares in particular companies, maybe, you know, 30 to 40 times, as it were, as I've increased my confidence in the particular company and its ability to deliver.
And for new investors, how much time do you think they ought to be able to allocate each week to investing? I mean, not if they're investing, say, £1,000, but say they've started to build their portfolio. How much time do you think it takes to manage your portfolio?
It's very difficult to say. I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about the stock market and reading about the stock market because, you know, it's been a huge interest and hobby of mine over the years, leaving one side the financial gain. Maybe a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours a week, but not necessarily reading time, but maybe thinking about it, as it were. Maybe also thinking how events that happen within one's own country, economically or internationally, politically, might affect the companies that one is invested in or the companies that you're thinking about investing in. But at the end of the day, it's not got to be hard work. I mean, it seems to me, you either really enjoy the stock market and find it interesting and want to read more, or you don't. And if you don't, then fair enough, let other people, let your stockbroker or your wealth manager or your IFA or whoever take the decisions for you. Although I think that having read Yummy, you at least will be aware of what they're doing and why. But I hope that people will want to study more, to read more, will become excited about the stock market, interested in it, and therefore want to do it. If it's hard work, let others do it for you. You've got to want to do it yourself. So, you know, I think there is a clear distinction between those two types of investor.
And do you think it's a prerequisite to be waking up at 4-7 o'clock to be able to see all the announcements as they come out?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I although I'm a very much a long-term investor, at 7 o'clock in the morning these days, and I've only started doing it in the last 12 months or so, you know, I plug in and you look at the announcements of the day, as it were, insofar as they affect companies that I'm either invested in or might be invested in or interested in. The long-term investor doesn't need to study prices or watch prices on a day-to-day basis. I want them to invest in a company that they believe has long-term potential and stay with that and not worry too much about short-term price movements.
And just remind us again of the top line caveats that you're looking for in a company that you are happy to invest in.
Right. And they're all common sense. And so they would be, first of all, a company that is already established and is making profits and is paying dividends. A business that you understand and believe has got long-term potential and long-term growth. A board of directors and financial advisors with some stability. In other words, you don't want to invest in a company where they've changed financial director 5 times in the last 6 years. It's fairly obvious that there is something a little bit wrong there, danger signals. You want a company, ideally, that is cash rich or doesn't overborrow. And once again, that is common sense. So those are sort of the basic things that you're looking for. And if you find an investing company is like that, then you're much less likely to lose money.
So we've got Brexit happening at the moment, and it's affected some companies more than others. Definitely the exchange rate with the weak sterling is a problem.
Sure.
The uncertainty in the economy is causing some businesses to stutter. Has it affected companies that you hold?
It hasn't affected too many, thankfully, because my ideal is to invest in a smaller quoted UK company, but one that trades internationally, already trades internationally. So you have the advantage of rather better UK governance, corporate governance, but you're backing a company that hopefully does acknowledge that emerging markets, the third world, are the greater growth markets. I don't invest directly myself in overseas companies or in, say the Indian economy or the Vietnamese economy or the Chinese economy. But many of the companies that I'm invested in do obviously trade in those markets. I say to quite a number of people who talk about Brexit from an investment point of view and sometimes tell me why they shouldn't be investing in a particular company at any one stage, I say to them, look, you are, in my view, applying too much intelligence to the problem. You can talk yourself out of investing in any company at any stage because of worries about Brexit, you know, the US-Chinese trade talks, trade disputes, trouble with Iran, trouble in risks in Korea. You know, there are always plenty of negatives around in the world. But at the end of the day, if you do have savings, and a fortune to have savings, believe in savings, then it does make sense, I believe, to invest in good UK companies, both in terms of building up your own worth, but also because actually it's helping our national economy as well. We want to encourage people to save. We want to encourage people to back genuine businesses that create wealth, that employ people. It is all worthwhile. It all hangs together. So I don't let events like Brexit really affect my own investment decisions too much. But the key is to avoid losses if you can, and to avoid borrowing on shares. You really only want to invest your own savings, your own money, and then not all your money in shares. I always believe in saying to people, keep a proportion of your money in cash. You never know what family emergency. I call it sometimes heart bypass money, as it were. You must never put all your money into the stock market, because there is an element of risk. But at the end of the day, if you don't invest in property or the stock market or growing businesses, then your money actually just sits there in the bank. In the current era, it's getting next to no rate of interest. And indeed, with inflation, you're actually losing a certain amount each year. So from every point of view, it does make sense to encourage people to invest and save.
So you haven't really changed your positioning because of Brexit. There have been no companies that you thought would be more under threat and that you needed.
No, I can't think of one that I've sold or one that I particularly invested in or changed position because of Brexit. But as I say, most of my holdings do trade internationally, and therefore I think, and also are fairly established businesses and are conservatively managed. And therefore, I think we'll be able to withstand the negatives of Brexit.
So the first half of this year has had more profit warnings than the same period last year. How do you react when you read a profit warning first thing in the morning?
Well, when a profit warning comes out first thing in the morning, as it were, when you hear about it, there is a sinking, sick feeling in the stomach, because obviously it normally results in quite a fall in a share price. But if you're investing for the long term, which I am, you've got to accept that there will be years in a company's development and life where things don't go as well, and therefore if there is a problem one year, provided it's not a problem that is really going to bring the whole company down, it still makes sense, I think, to stay aboard if you believe in that company and in that investment. If, on the other hand, you're really upset by the warning and also by a cut in the dividend, and it's a company that you don't know too well, perhaps it's best to sell, to take that loss on the chin, and to move on to other things. And in more recent years, I've brought in to my own investment philosophy what I term a stop loss, which I believe to be around, or should be around, 20%. So if something you buy has fallen 20%, ask yourself seriously, have I got this wrong? Have I made a mistake? And if I have, take it on the chin, move on. Because if you have a share in your portfolio, which is a real dog, where you've lost a lot of money, where you've got it wrong, not only is it unfortunate financially, for obvious reasons, but also every time you look at your share portfolio, every time you read about that company where you're showing a big loss, it pricks you. It reminds you of the mistake you've made, and it can inhibit and not your confidence. So there's a lot to be said for getting rid of any bad apple, throwing it out or cutting it out if you can, and moving on. As I've said before, we all make mistakes.
And with microcaps, the spread can be quite large. You know, it might be 5 or 7%. So if you're selling out with a 20% stop loss, you're suddenly stopped out on a relatively small movement. Do you widen it with microcaps?
No, I mean, I think it's a little bit arbitrary. It doesn't necessarily have to be absolutely 20%, but I think at that level, you really seriously have to consider whether you should continue to hold that stock. And I've never worried too much about the difference between sort of buying and selling prices and a few pennies. And so many people, in my view, miss out because they read about a particular company when the shares are, say, 50p. And by the time they get onto their stockbroker or whoever, the shares have risen to 54p or 55p. And they think, oh, I'm not going to chase that, as it were. Now, I say to them, that's a mistake. Because in 5 or 10 years' time, you've either got it right or you've got it wrong. You don't say in 10 years' time, well, if only I'd bought the shares at 51p rather than 54p. It is irrelevant in longer-term investing. So if you really believe in a company, if you want to invest in it, don't be put off because it's risen only by a few pence.
And with your stop losses, are they automatic stop losses or are they a mental stop
They're a
loss?
mental stop loss. And so you're not instructing a stockbroker or whoever to say, if my share falls 20%, automatically sell. In my case, I'm making a human or personal judgment. And of course, you also have to modify that approach in case the stock market itself falls. I mean, so if there's a big fall in stocks and shares overall, a lot of the things that you bought may well fall below 20%. So you shouldn't be selling on that basis. Because long term, if you look at the economy in the Western world, we have seen growth. And although there are times when the stock market does fall substantially, usually there's been a recovery afterwards.
And when we're talking small caps, the position size, you don't have to have a very large position, and yet it's way over the minimum electronic market size. So as your position grows, which we know that back in 2003 your portfolio was 1 million and you have about 20 holdings, I believe. So by maths, that's at least £50,000 per holding. To try and get out when it gets 50,000 and above is not easy. So your stop loss is hit. What do you do then?
Yes, well, that is the flip side of building up significant positions in companies, and you've got to accept that if one does go wrong, you've got a fairly substantial amount in it. Obviously, there is a fair amount of bruising, but you have to weigh that up with the converse, where if you really believe in a company and you are substantially invested in it and it delivers, you can do very well indeed. And so, in my case, I've got companies that represent probably maybe 20%, 25% of my overall portfolio, as it were. Some would say you're once taking a great risk, but I maintain that I know those companies well. I think it's very, very unlikely that they're going to let me down. And overall, it's a policy that actually has delivered for me over the years.
But the fact is, you wouldn't be able to get out of them,
No,
should you want
no, you
to.
wouldn't. Just as I've indicated that in some cases, to build up my holding, I've bought on maybe 30 or 40 occasions. One wouldn't, and so one's probably trapped because you wouldn't be the only person selling. Others would be trying to sell as well. So, it would involve quite a bruising, quite a blow. But overall, hopefully, if you've followed the sort of guidelines that I've suggested, you will have more positives than negatives, and overall do well. But you've got to accept that there is always an element of risk with investing.
So, as your portfolio got bigger, did it make you more likely to invest in larger cap stocks, say 100, 250, 350, rather than small cap and AIM?
No. It's not my interest and my investment in smaller cap stocks continues. And I've not gone for, you know, the larger cap stocks, as it were. I find that the small cap stocks can grow more quickly, tend to be less well researched, and had a lot of fun, obviously, discovering stocks that others are unaware of, or fewer people are aware of, and you know, many of those have been successful. That's part of the fun of, you know, hunting for the next growth stocks.
So which ponds are you fishing in? Do you go 350, or will you only go small cap and AIM?
Oh no. Not only go, but I would say that let's put it this way, I think the average capitalization of the companies that I'm in, the average capitalization would probably be now maybe 200, 250 million, something like that. But I would go right the way down to investing in something where the stock market capitalization would only be maybe 20 million pounds, something like that. The smaller the better in many ways.
Would you go smaller than 20 million?
Yes, I have gone smaller than 20 million.
What's your cutoff?
I would say I have no cutoff at all. If I found something that was really attractive that was only capitalized at, you know, 5, 7, 10 million, I would still invest in it.
Many thanks indeed. I think we'll have to leave it there for this one, but we'll be back again for a part two.
My pleasure. Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.